You've worked hard to build your brand, so why settle for one-size-fits-all branded clothing? Lands' End Outfitters creates apparel your employees will truly want to wear that unites your team in comfort and style. It's clothing that bolsters your brand identity and creates a unique connection between your brand, your employees, and your customers. It's why Lands' End Outfitters has been a supplier of branded apparel to some of the world's most respected brands for more than 30 years. From logo polos to fully customized branded wardrobes, our world-class outfitters will partner with you to help you and your team feel confident on the job and put your brand into action. From logo application to online ordering, Lands' End Outfitters offers seamless solutions that give you peace of mind, all backed by above and beyond expertise. See why Lands' End Outfitters should be your branded apparel partner. Go to business.landsend.com/pod20 and use code POD20 for 20% off your first product. That's business.landsend.com/pod20. Code POD20 for 20% off your first product.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by John Cunningham, who's Relationship Director with Morgan McKinley, Valerie Cox, journalist and author, and Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times. And we have to start with domestic politics, because domestic politics is everywhere across the papers. Pages and pages of coverage, pages of analysis, and particularly in the Sunday Independent, pages of polls. Their headline is Gap Between Big Two Titans as Martin Targets Fine Gael. Valerie, you had a look through this. Is there anything in the numbers that particularly stood out for you, or anything in the numbers that surprised you?
Well, I mean, the one thing always is the number of people they speak to, 1,852, which actually, you know, it isn't a very high number, really, to build such a major opinion poll on. I mean, I thought it was very interesting in that if you look through the results, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Independents, that is the preferred choice of everybody. But the collapse of the Sinn Féin vote is also very interesting because, you know, there was a time, a very short time ago, before the local elections and so on, where Sinn Féin were riding so high and everybody assumed that Mary Lou would be the next Taoiseach. Now, that has totally changed, as we know from the local elections. And interestingly enough, Sinn Féin are not divulging the number of candidates they have in the next election. They were saying they had 39. That was 6 weeks ago. But there's a professor in Maynooth University who's been keeping tags on who might be running for Sinn Féin, and he reckons they have 59 candidates at the moment. Now, interesting enough, there are constituencies where their gains over the last few years made people think they would be putting in like 3-4 candidates. And in fact, they disrupted a lot of constituencies last time round in the last general election, because many of their candidates, there was a number one vote and the vote didn't continue down the paper. So a lot of people who might have been in or might have been there with a shout didn't get it because of the singular Sinn Féin voting. But now it looks like they're not putting lots of people into each constituency. They're not saying, and it's very hard to find out, but it looks like we're not going to have an avalanche of Sinn Féin candidates. Then we've got Fine Gael.
Now, hang on, before you move off the issue, because this, Fionnán Sheehan focuses on this in the Indo. He says that he asked Sinn Féin for a list of candidates. Unfortunately, yeah, we don't have a full list available to distribute yet, the party says, when asked for its latest ticket selections. Treating your candidates like the third secret of Fatima isn't the brightest idea when pollsters are about to go up on lampposts in 5 days' time. Why would they be reluctant? Am I missing something? What's the significance in their reluctance?
I think they don't want to be questioned about it before it happens. I mean, that's one good reason, because it's going to be a negative questioning. You know, political correspondents are going to get out there and say, why are you only putting so many people in Wicklow, Roscommon or whatever? But I think also it's got an awful lot to do with people's perception of whether Mary Lou could be Taoiseach. And I mean, at the moment, Sinn Féin's only on 18%, and only 1 in 8 people believe that Mary Lou will be Taoiseach. So, I mean, that, you know, they're calling it an omerta. That's what Fionnán calls it, an omerta in Sinn Féin, as Brand Harris gains. And of course, we know Brand Harris is gaining at the moment. And in relation to Fine Gael, they're also, I mean, they have so many problems at the moment because of the disappearance of their big names who are guaranteed to bring in another seat, Heather Humphreys, Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney. So they're wondering, who are they going to put into these constituencies? Because the big problem is they don't have that many brand names in many rural constituencies. I mean, places like Wicklow, yes. I mean, they've had Harris and Donnelly. Well, no, Donnelly's not theirs, but there's big brand names. But there's other constituencies where they're bringing in people who've been members of the party for many, many years. They've announced many of the names. And I've never heard of them. And I'm sure a lot, you know, people who are going to vote. So they have a very short time to get these people out there into your homes.
The significance of that is outlined by Kevin Cunningham, who's the boss of Ireland Thinks, because he's explaining that not for the first time, but more and more in recent years, there is a gap between party affiliation and actual voting preference.
Yeah.
That you might be a Fine Gael voter, but if you don't recognise the person on the doorstep, you may throw the vote the other way.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, about the whole doorstep thing, whether that's kind of fading out a bit, because there's so many places now where candidates cannot go, like gated communities, people having electric gates as well on their homes. There's an awful lot. I mean, you go into the housing estates, yes, and people will engage you on the doorsteps. But I actually think there's so much time wasted on that. I mean, I went out a few times with Mary O'Rourke, the late Mary O'Rourke, the wonderful Mary O'Rourke, and she's confided in me. She loved canvassing, but her major worry was dogs. She was terrified of dogs. And with that, we went around a corner and a huge big thing like a Labrador came galloping towards her and she ran in the other direction. I mean, there's a lot of hazards out there for canvassers.
There's a lesson in how to avoid canvassers in this. John, you want to come in?
But the poll says here that there's 70% of people have had nobody call to the door, all right? And that just to me demonstrates. So back to your point, your question about the Sinn Féin thing. Think of the last election and the devastation that was wrought on them for not running enough candidates. And to me, to be here today and they're not giving the list out, if they get this wrong, they could end up with less seats. If you end up putting in 20 candidates into one constituency, they may get no seat at all. But what's really kind of, I think, astonishing, and this is now the third or fourth month we've had this conversation, the Sinn Féin comeback hasn't happened. They seem to be all over the place. They've gone really quiet. Mary Lou is obviously struggling. You know, the Shandy thing, all that. But to me, to be going into the next election, which could be in 2 weeks' time or in 3 weeks' time, to say that they haven't yet decided on the list, to me, is strategic political suicide, I would have thought.
Now, anytime, if we do talk about the slide in Sinn Féin vote, there is a tendency to think, well, it is picking on Sinn Féin. But the reality is, it's one of the most remarkable and precipitous drops that we've seen in party support. And it's quite difficult to explain because there's been some recent challenges for the party, but the slide started long before then. We've dropped, I think, from mid-30s now to 18%. And Mary Lou MacDonald gone from the assumed Taoiseach to only 31% and down 3 again in this most recent poll. To what do you attribute it, Mark?
Well, I mean, the traditional response to that is that it's the question of immigration, although I think if you look at the numbers, you'll see that their difficulties started slightly before that. They've obviously been exacerbated by immigration and the kind of people in constituencies who would traditionally have been seen as being people that Sinn Féin could attract would have quite often very strong views on immigration, and then they saw the party trying to ride several horses at various times. Now, you can argue that every party tried to do the same thing. So in some ways, Sinn Féin has paid a bigger penalty for similar attitudes to everybody else. But it's a bigger problem for them because that cohort is gone and it doesn't appear to be showing any sign of coming back. That's going to have all sorts of impacts in terms of the numbers of independent candidates that are elected this time around, many of whom have a very strong personality.
All of which themselves. Makes great sense. But the thing is, immigration, according to this, is about 23% of people are saying it's the most significant issue. I would have thought if you went back to Sinn Féin 18 months ago and you said, look, when the election comes up, the number one issue that people will talk about is housing. The number two is cost of living. The number three is healthcare. Could you pick better ground to fight the election?
No, you couldn't. But the problem is that people go often on sentiment and feeling. And the cohort of people who were responsible for that huge increase in Sinn Féin's vote are people who are disproportionately irritated and annoyed and concerned about the issue. And in some ways, more honest in terms of their attitudes, in that this is their opinion, and they're prepared to penalise somebody for not having it, whereas, you know, people in middle class constituencies will talk out of both sides of their mouth, you know. So they do have that that difficulty, and that isn't coming back. Now, the question with that cohort is in inner city constituencies, but not just, and in particular rural constituencies, is will they come out to vote for somebody on the day of, and we don't know about that. You then have the whole issue of November campaigning, and very few of the people who are involved have any memory of how bloody miserable it is.
It's been a very mild November so far.
It has been a very mild November, and let us hope and pray that it will stay that way. But calling to the door, you don't call to the door of people's houses in rural Ireland anymore at 5 o'clock on a dark November evening. And if you do, you're not going to be madly welcome unless they know you at the gate.
Now, Valerie Cox, the owner Bryn speaking to us yesterday, said that in his view, the challenge for Sinn Féin has been the incapacity to get the message to land, and that they are deciding they're going to put shoulders to the wheel with increased alacrity in the campaign, and that'll have an effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, they had so much of a buzz around the last general election. They really had. And I suppose in many ways we haven't seen that materialise into action. But I thought there was an interesting piece too in the Business Post this morning from Shane Coleman. And he said the true support base for Sinn Féin could actually be higher. The race is far tighter than the bookies' odds would suggest. And he said, if anybody's telling you that, you know, this is a definite result, he said, that's a load. They're just talking Ramesh, because the whole thing is too close to call. I know in the last general election, in my own constituency of Wicklow, Sinn Féin were just, I mean, there was such a buzz about them. And that's gone very, very flat. I mean, they still have a Sinn Féin TD and all the rest of it. But I also think it's a question of the coalition parties taking over the mantle of Sinn Féin in some ways. Because Sinn Féin were talking about housing, not so much about immigration, but housing, housing, housing. And now we hear, well, I mean, my answer to the major parties would be, OK, you're talking about it now, but you had plenty of years to implement it. And that comes through very, very clearly in Micheál Martin's interview this morning in the Sunday Independent. I mean, I think it's an absolute disgrace. He says his number one priority is housing. And then his number two is he wants teams of therapists working with children in schools. But he wants to be Taoiseach again. He says, because I'm hungry. Hungry to be Taoiseach, hungry for power. And he talks about, again, housing, housing, housing. But I mean, he's the one who's been in power for many of those years, and he certainly could have done something then. He said,
But the basics haven't changed, and the basics don't become any easier, whether you have a Sinn Féin Taoiseach or whether you have a Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael or anybody else. We have a sclerotic planning system. We have a sclerotic relationship with local authorities who bear huge levels of responsibility for the failures of the last 20 years. And to try and get things done doesn't become any easier, depending on whether you change the flag. I mean, if you look at Owen Murphy's upcoming book and Harry McGee's interview yesterday, where he talks about at one point. In fact, Murphy has become more interesting out of office than he ever was when he was in it, because the book, from what the excerpts I've seen, are quite remarkable. But he wanted to declare some form of national emergency on housing and to try and do responses in the same way that we did with COVID. Now, we'd have had all sorts of legal issues, so how much of that was possible or not. But it's an interesting attitude. And it is going to take something like that for us to deal with a historic problem with housing.
But book goes to Valerie's point, though. Owen Murphy says that for his period in housing, he describes himself as a failure. He describes the commitment to the private sector at the expense of the public sector as an ideological error, and that it was that it failed. No. And he describes an incapacity to get the government system to actually act on the problem.
Exactly, and that's my point. It's the difficulty of getting our system collectively to move quickly in one direction at one time. We were able to do it with COVID. We've been able to do it on one or two other occasions in the past. We are demonstrably unable to do it on this particular occasion. And the idea that the public at large would accept the consequences of a successful implementation of that policy is very questionable. Because you turn around to people and you say, we're putting a six-story apartment next to you, and by the way, we're not really interested in what your opinion is. see how you do with that.
This, I can almost hear Owen O'Brien saying, hang on a minute, I have detailed exactly how we would achieve all of this in the recent 100 and something page, very detailed document.
It could be 900 pages, I don't think it matters too much. You asked a question about, here we are coming into this election. Sinn Féin have demonstrated to all of us in their political genius, their communication has been consistent, repetitive and has had impact. To find themselves, and Owen's talking yesterday about getting their heads around the communication message to me, demonstrates that they're in crisis and they have failed to come up with the message. And I think at this stage people have lost faith. And back to that 15% of the middle class people I would have met who said, at once I'd give them a go. Hmm. That is gone and dead in the water. Hmm. The €300,000 house, the constant reference to the failed state, people have had enough of it. So I have to say that, you know...
But how do you square this then, John? If you look at the rest of the poll, do you believe the outgoing government did a good or bad job in relation to each of the following? I won't go into the detail of every sub-bracket, but essentially, do you think they did a good job in immigration? Most people think, no, you did a bad or very bad job of it. Do you think you did a good job on healthcare? No, bad or very bad job of it. Do you think you did a good job on housing? No, bad or very bad job of it. Crime, bad or very bad job of it. Yet, we're going to put them straight back in. Yeah. How do you square those two things?
I think, I suppose, first of all, there's a thing about stability, I think, somewhere coming into this. And again, we've touched on the American election and we've seen what's happened in the UK. But there's a certain sense of comfort of getting it half right, okay? And the fact that you've got these experiences, I mean, I think when we were on the last time, we had this conversation about Simon Harris when he came in, and there's this huge concern that this Duracell bunny approach that he'd end up with kind of, you know, with tuberculosis by the end of the first month, he'd be so exhausted, okay? And here we are in November now, and in fairness, and he has to be given credit for it, he has made a difference. The balance has been sustained. He has empathy and intelligence and he's engaged with people and he's all the energy in the world. So I think people weren't expecting that. And I think that they got caught off guard. And I think that, you know, as Valerie said, there's 1,000 people in the survey, okay? And we can swing left or right, okay? The bottom line is, and this is what we've got to be really, really clear about, in the context of what's going on in the world at the moment, we're living in one of the greatest little countries in the world. Stop. Fundamentally, it works. Democracy is working. The judiciary, society at large is engaged and qualified. So in relative terms to other countries and other organisations, we're actually doing quite well. So we mustn't lose sight of that fact. And I think that, Anton, when push comes to shove, to me, the bursting of the Sinn Féin bubble is something we can't take for granted. I think if it's been said already, between now and the election date, only God knows what could happen. Yeah. I mean, even before I came in this morning, you're going on the radio, waiting to
and
see.
And Kevin Cunningham has made that point, that the polling only really becomes true as it gets closer. 53106, by the way, if you want to get in touch, or 87 1400.
There's a schizophrenic sense in all of us, in the sense that we are working in a country, or living in a country that has a functioning court system, a functioning tax system, a functioning political system, whatever one thinks about it. And yet, if you go into any bar in Ireland and ask people their opinions, people are pretty browned off, and I could use far stronger words. So you have this sense that people have a certain lack of faith in the ability of any political agglomeration. No matter what, on all of your heads.
Yeah.
There's a touch of that. So people are judging parties against a slightly different metric. You know, we're not expecting heroes to come over over the hill anymore, to an extent.
But that was the problem. You know, people who've been around for years and have been arguably very good politicians, you know, they have missed out on things that they didn't force through because they didn't have the power, they didn't have the clout, they were up against the odds, as you mentioned, maybe. But I mean, here you have Micheál Martin saying, I want that started on day one, no arguments about it. But then he starts talking about the passenger cap at Dublin Airport. And he says, well, there's no way you can break the law getting it done. But we have to get it done. And he talks about doing it collectively. And then he goes on to whinge about Fine Gael sources calling him a grumpy old man and says that's ageism. But I mean, when he was Taoiseach, he had the power to do these things.
He didn't have the power in terms of Dublin Airport. The Dublin Airport cap is down to Fine Gael County Council. You know,
yeah, like, and the county councils have too much power.
It's the problem when you take any spanner out of the box. You discover that you're using the wrong nut.
What do you make of him being annoyed at being told he's cranky? Other than the enjoyable irony of it.
Grumpy.
Was it grumpy or cranky? Hang on, let me...
A grumpy
man. No, he said, apparently I was cranky. I just think it's so superficial and shallow. That kind of stuff is just silly. And then he goes on with the ageism thing.
Yeah, well, I think what this article proves is that Micheál Martin is not running for Ársann Uachtaráin, and he definitely wants to be Taoiseach again. So we can take him off that list. Because I have to say that up until a few weeks ago, I really thought, and I'd heard comments that his family were, they wouldn't want him to go to New York or Brussels or Zurich, but they'd allow him to go to the park. So this interview, from my perspective, is putting a very, very clear mark in the sand. I won't be the candidate for the Horus and Uachtaráin, and I want to be Taoiseach again, full stop. And that to me is, I think, really interesting. I think that, that again, you can be cynical about the why didn't you get it done. Here's a man who I have to say that, you know, he's grown on me certainly over the last few years, and he is now to me a really competent, experienced politician who's got better in the last 18 months or 2 years. And I suppose I'd rather see him inside the tent than outside of this stage.
Well, as I said, there's buckets of politics. There's tons of domestic politics. There's obviously also a lot of US politics. And before you think, oh no, we don't want any more analysis of Trump, this is analysis of the impact of some of the potential policies, because both the Business Post and the Times are looking at the possibility of a Republican administration and what that will mean for us here. And what they're saying is it won't mean anything pretty. We'll get into that after this break. Mark, let me start with you on US politics, because what we're looking at now and what a lot of the papers are looking at is the aftermath of the election rather than the election itself. And if we see a Republican administration returned, particularly if it's a Republican president and a Republican Congress, what this will mean for Irish business and the Irish economy? And the answer seems to be bad news.
Well, yes, definitely in terms of the case of Trump, because he is determined to take action. And if and this is dependent upon him having a majority in Congress. If he has that, if he wins and if he has the majority, then there is a chance that they could take action that would really, really impact on us. And I don't think we in Ireland understand how disastrous dissemination of the $25 billion surplus has been to our international reputation. You know, this, if ever there was a time for the Department of Finance literally to find sofas to put down money behind, this was an occasion.
Why?
You saw there was a senior executive from Cantor Fitzgerald on Bloomberg the other day, and he was literally hyperventilating over the issue of the Irish surplus and the way in which it is living proof to anybody in the US who think they're being ridden bareback by Ireland when it comes to...
We're getting half of our corporation tax off.
Well, that's the point. Like, we are. I mean, there's a reason why this stuff is there. And, you know, everything that's being done is legal, and it's down to intellectual property rights mostly being held in Ireland. Therefore, that's the justification for the payments coming through and therefore being taxed. And all of that is legally sound, but all of that can be changed by diktat from Washington, particularly in a situation where Trump is laying it down. And you see going into the election that an awful lot of people who've put Jamie Dimon and Morgan Stanley and all these people, they've put millions and millions into the Harris campaign. None of them are coming out publicly to endorse her, because they are all bloody terrified that Trump will go for them on the other side. And we have a problem with our taxation. He tried to do things in the last in his first administration, failed miserably to actually take a policy and create an executive action out of it. We'd need to be hopeful that he'd be equally failing to do it a second time around.
As I understand it, John Cunningham, the first major threat is that he drops US corporation tax to 15%, which puts it at parity with us and the rest of the EU, and therefore causes a lot of US multinationals to say, you know what, lads, pack the bags, we're heading for Kansas or Dallas or Santa Paula.
Well, I think, first of all, that is the case, and he said the 21-15%, but let's be realistic. For the American economy and access to Europe, Ireland has become that access to the EMEA market, okay? One of the biggest markets in the world. So let's be clear about things. You're not going to see on a Monday morning people shutting down and moving out. I think it'd be more gradual.
No, it's nothing like that.
Yeah, it's going to be gradual. So the reality is, as we know, that there's a huge amount of tax paid through Ireland that resides within the Republic of Ireland. We get paid the tax. He wants to bring them back. Now, I think the point here ultimately is that, one, we've got to navigate this really carefully. I don't think it'll be devastating, but it'll certainly readjust the balance of revenue for the government in the short to in the medium to long term. But the bottom line again is, it's about Ireland again looking about this open economy and our dependency on the United States, and looking at the global context of whether it's the BRICS going to India and China and others from the point of view of diversifying the risk, because our open economy is the essence of our success, and we've got to embrace that. I mean, Heather Humphreys did a really remarkable job, I think, in the last few years in focusing on SMEs and investing locally, okay, but it hasn't been enough to strike that balance. But be very clear again that the Trump thing is, you know, and here we are today now, it's Tuesday is the election, and all you can hear from people is saying it's knife edge. You couldn't call it either way. So whether women come out and swing the vote, whatever else, we'll have to wait and see. But the bottom line is, don't mind Ireland. Trump, from my perspective, if he's elected president, he's not good for the world. And Ireland will be potentially...
Well, let's get to the world in a while, but let's deal with problems close to home first. I mean, if we look at a situation, I mean, the quote in the Irish Times, in the Sunday Times, I should say, says, and this is from a source who's reputed to have been involved in the briefing at the Taoiseach, there are a number of scenarios that have been presented to the Taoiseach, and he's aware that the impact of a Trump administration in Ireland would be significant and negative.
Yeah, it would, but just to be clear on the point, the threat is not to multinationals' operations in Ireland. There are very good reasons why they're here, why they're servicing the EU market, whatever. The threat is to Ireland's use as a tax vehicle for multinationals and where that money could be. Affected.
Which is hugely profitable and keeps a lot of the lights on.
Of course it does. And we'd be running a $6 billion deficit. This year, which is a fact that we never seem to mention, if you were to take out those sums. So, you know, that is the problem that we have, that we are uniquely dependent upon changes that could be made. Now, in the last administration, in his first administration, he was uniquely awful at taking an idea and bringing it through all the way to an actual executive action. This time round, the people around him, not so much him himself, but the people around him are far smarter. They've done an awful lot more planning. They're much more ready to go on day one should he get a second run. So quite how it would work out, I don't think anybody can be absolutely certain. But it isn't going to be good news for us. The question is how bad it'll be.
Yeah. And the other thing, of course, Valerie Cox, is that it's not just the impact of creating corporation tax parity and what that will do. The other thing that he's talking about is a tariff war. There are suggestions that the EU and the US will end up in the kind of tariff war that he has been saying he wants to create with China.
I mean, if he seriously goes ahead with it, it's quite frightening. In fact, Vincent Boland in the Business Post said that he's set to pursue an economic agenda that will risk the world economy falling apart. But if you look at the other threats he's made, plans, I suppose he calls them. For example, cars being imported into the United States. He says, well, look, you know, we're not getting any money out of this. And he wants to put something like 100% tariff on them. And then other things that are coming in from, say, China, you know, huge quantities of things. He says up 50%, whatever. But what he's not looking at is, he's saying, look, let's bring all this business back to America. Let's manufacture all this stuff ourselves. But then, who are the manufacturers going to be? Who are the people going to be who are working? They're all the immigrants that he's going to try and get rid of, the hundreds of thousands of people. So, like, it's very mixed up thinking. But actually, I think what's going to happen after the election, assuming that Trump is elected, is that our ministers, our heads of industry, they're going to have to go to Trump and do a bit of grovelling. Because I think that's the only way we're going to stop him and his advisors slapping tariffs or, you know, bringing down corporate tax so that they're paying a great deal less in Ireland. I mean, I don't profess to be a tax expert, but he definitely has us in his sights.
He isn't using terms quite that pejorative, but that's what Bertie Ahern is quoted as saying, effectively.
Yeah, but again, I think back to Valerie's point, if he's elected president of the United States, we have to respect that as an outcome. And let me tell you, won't we be absolutely thrilled to have Patrick stay in the White House if he doesn't cancel it, okay? And all of a sudden again, they'll be shaking hands and they'll be passing around the babies and selfies been taken.
And there'll be tariffs on the shamrock.
But the point is ultimately, we will have to suck up an awful lot of the indignant kind of attitude that we've had with regard to our view of America. I mean, just quickly again, and we're all a bit shocked by this, but I was at a dinner recently in town. I met an American couple who sat beside us. She was a teacher in her late 20s from New York. He was a Tesla worker from New Jersey, and it transpired they were Trumpers. My pal said to her, on what basis could you as a woman vote for this man? And they both intervened and said, sorry, I said, you're missing the point here. The only pretext in which we make a decision with regard to the election is, who's best for me? So if Donald Trump gave them $50 more and he was eating children for breakfast, they couldn't care less. They had no sense of John Locke society, those in the margins. And that to me was this really clear sense of, let's not over-intellectualise this. There's a really basic, narcissistic, materialistic view with regard to how decisions are made.
And if you look at blue-collar workers, and you talk to Larry Donnelly and people like that with knowledge of the Irish-American community, and you see all of those kind of people whose lives today are significantly poorer than the lives that their parents enjoyed 40 years ago. You know, there have been structural changes to the economic model in the US and elsewhere that have militated against the working class. And these people are sick of it, and Trump has given them an opportunity to land a slap. The fact that he's a lunatic and he's a whole variety of other things is neither here nor there. They see themselves as operating in a society where there is no safety net. They worry only about themselves, and anybody who is, as John is saying, appeals to that self-interest is going to work. And in the same way that you saw with Mary Robinson in her election in 1990 here, it was Manon the Heron who did it. All of our conversation has been predicated on the basis that it's a Trump victory, and none of us can be sure about that. And the Iowa poll that
polls would suggest.
Yeah, the Iowa poll, maybe, you know, is there a silent vote out there? If there is, it's a silent female vote. And if Trump is to be denied, it's going to be Manon Astott who are going to be the ones who will be responsible for it. And whether they go into polling stations and vote quietly, we'll see.
There's we'll be covering that with a more detailed analysis coming up after the 11 o'clock news. This is the Iowa poll and what the implications are for the national polls and the likely national outturn. This may be a slightly tangential point, but is there a lesson in this for Europe in terms of getting ourselves together as a more cohesive, unified force politically and in the globe? I look at what happened in Spain during the week.
Yeah.
And if that happened in America, you would have the federal government stepping in. You'd have huge FEMA support. You would have other states providing workers. Yeah. There was no sense of that across Europe.
No, there wasn't. But the European Union has 1% of gross revenues. So, you know, I was watching Euronews the other night, and there was this implication in the interview that a commission spokesman was being interviewed. Now, particularly, he wasn't somebody that you'd necessarily volunteer to put in front of a microphone, given the state of his performance. But nevertheless, his basic point was, we have X billion for this and we have Y billion for that, and we're doing the best that we can with very limited sums of money, you know. We're not comparing like with like, and there are times when we want the European Union to behave like a big beast, and at the same time, any time when anybody asks to give it extra powers, most of our reactions are, thank you very much, but no, thank you.
But before we get to trying to fix Europe, okay, what became really clear to me is, what do we have control with within Ireland, okay? And in a world where democracy is under threat, okay, the most important thing that the people listening to this programme to do is vote. Mm. To think we're coming up for a general election and you may get 65% of the people voting, which means that almost half the people in this country are either not bothered or don't care. The number of young people I know who have never voted, and the number of people my age and older who have stopped voting. First of all, it should be called out. It's a disgrace. Mm-hmm. People need to vote. And the more people that vote, you have to suspect that we get a better result overall with regard to these polls and everything else. So to me, there's the call to action for us, as, you know, Ursula von der Leyen is enough to get on with at the moment, okay? If you could sort out our own little backyard and protect what we've got, because this all feels so fragile and so weak from the point of view of getting it wrong. And again, I spoke to somebody recently, a British person, a senior British person, and I said, he said, I don't think people in Ireland realise how lucky they are to have the quality of the politicians that we have in this country compared to what's happening in the UK and others. So we've got to protect that.
My God.
People get out and vote.
The texts don't necessarily reflect that view. Have we had not enough at this stage of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil? 100 years for crying out loud. What employer would re-employ a failure? The unfortunate thing about this period of time in politics in Ireland is that there are only two real choices, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil combined and Sinn Féin with some other mix. Another Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in again, and people will still be complaining about the same things in 5 years' time. Nobody's blaming but ourselves.
If that is the view of your callers, then they know what to do and go out to the polling station and vote for Sinn Féin.
53106 at a cost of 30 cents, 087 1400 106. Before we move on, and you're talking about the state of politics across the water, John, in the UK, we must talk about that because there is a new Conservative leader, not with a bang, but with a whimper. Never has somebody taken over the leadership of the Tories with so little public recognition. Before that, though, I think a man who you have all shared space in this studio with, and Valerie was a colleague of yours for a long time in an RTE, the sad passing this week of David Davenport. Lovely piece in the Mail, John Lee
lovely
talking
piece
about
in the Mail,
it.
Yeah. And I think what was really nice about it was, I mean, we've had all the tributes paid to David. He was an actual icon, which you can't say about very many people, but he covered everything that happened over a couple of decades. And, you know, his voice was synonymous with everything. The Belfast Agreement, everything. I mean, we associate his voice. We can still hear it in our heads. But what I thought was lovely about John Lee's piece was he showed David as the human being, as the man himself. And I thought that was lovely. He talked about his friendship with him. And the other day I was talking to another grandparent who shares grandchildren with David. And they were saying what a wonderful grandfather he was, that he was very hands-on, very helpful, always there for them, and that the kids absolutely adored him. And, you know, away from the public, David, I think it's lovely that you can have an accolade like that, that he was an ordinary human being as well, who, you know, obviously his family miss him terribly, and we send our sympathies to them this morning. It's just awful. But I think it's lovely that he's remembered as a human being rather than, you know, the correspondent, the political correspondent.
We will be back after this break. A new Conservative leader was elected yesterday morning, to not much in the way of fanfare, which is indicative of where the Conservatives find themselves. Mark Hennessy, of course, Britain and Ireland editor of the Irish Times, is the man to explain all to us. Kemi Badenoch has her work cut out for her.
She does. Now, having said that, she's in a better place than she could ever have imagined taking up this job, given the way in which Labour has proven to be so awful at basic politics since it's taken over. They're a divided party. They have a huge issue in terms of a talent pool. This is the Conservatives, a huge issue with talent pool. She has a reputation of being incredibly difficult to work with and deeply unpleasant quite frequently. Her friends say otherwise, but her friends are outnumbered by people who say the contrary. So
Margaret Thatcher was not known for being tremendous crack throughout the entire parliamentary party, but was very electorally successful.
Well, there's a difference. Sometimes Badenoch is put on the nasty end of things, whereas Thatcher, in fairness, would have gone through you over a philosophical point, but not necessarily have been personally unpleasant to you. You know, so she. We'll see. You know, I mean, they've got a very limited pool. I covered Robert Jenrick's by-election campaign when he won in Newark.
This was the defeated alternative.
Yeah. A good friend of mine came up with the nickname for him in a previous employment where he was called Generic, and the nickname has stuck. And you see the way in which they've been doing all sorts of wolf whistles in terms of immigration and a whole variety of other things. She's the first black leader of a political party in Britain. That is not an insignificant moment. Mm. It does go against the grain in terms of people saying that the Tories would never vote for a black leader. To be fair to the Conservatives, over the last 20 years, their record in terms of promoting ethnic minorities is vastly superior.
And gender minorities in terms of there has been Theresa May, Liz Truss, Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah,
they have a very good record in that.
Credit where credit is due. But, you know, I've seen her at conferences and stuff like that. And, you know, Badenoch has never impressed in terms of her speaking ability or her ability to get a hall going. But, you know, leadership sometimes becomes the person. We'll have to wait and see how it works out. But, you know, the most important thing is she should be dead and buried going into this job, because we should be looking at a two-term Labour government. And that, whilst it was certain on or as near certain as possible on the day after the election, it's less certain today.
Yeah. It's interesting, one of her first statements on her Renewal 2030, because she's talking about renewing the Conservatives, she has an overarching statement about the intent, and it says, "Our political system is broken. By design, it prevents us from being truly Conservative. We need something different. We need an engineer. I am an engineer."
Well,
it's the oddest
first of all,
core platform, isn't it?
I've watched what she said so far since she got elected. And she looked like somebody who was as surprised as anybody that she's been chosen to be leader of the Conservative Party. And her energy, and she actually to me had a very frightened look about her. Now, we'd have to give the woman a chance, okay? First of all, it is fantastic. She's a 44-year-old woman of colour who's now leading the Conservative Party. That's, I think, good news, all right? I mean, the party is broken and kind of fairly banjaxed at the moment, and the whole country feels like it's in a state of chassis. But she definitely looked like somebody who it just looked to me a bit shell-shocked with regard to the fact she's in. I mean, James Cleverly, I mean, you'd have been in that room with the whatever you call those, the 1924...
Oh, the 22 committee.
22 committee, okay. When Cleverly was knocked out, because they all clearly had him kind of as a shoe-in, all right? So look, I think no more than all that's going on in this country here, you're going to give this some time. I mean, the Labour Party looked like as if after all these years in opposition and having made such progress, they had no plan, they had no policies, and they're fumbling around in their handbag now looking for things to do and to say, and they're getting everything, but it feels like they're getting everything kind of wrong at the moment. But then to remind ourselves how lucky we are back to this thing about gratefulness, and Sister Stan's book launch this week, we are living in a country this year where there was a surplus to distribute. Rachel Reeves has been going around cutting everything, increasing taxes, and creating this extraordinarily moribund economy and society. Just remind ourselves that in this country, for all of its failings, lots to be grateful for.
Now, Mark has been dying to talk about this since 9 o'clock this morning, so, or 10 o'clock this morning, so it's time we finally gave him the opportunity. Peanut the squirrel, Mark.
Well, I actually don't want to talk about peanut the squirrel at all. In fact, I've been doing everything possible to talk about peanut. Put down, apparently, after he was a pet squirrel, who, an orphan pet squirrel, as Valerie reminded me during the break, to a single mother, apparently, as well, who was a house pet. And then there were complaints made by neighbours, and then animal control officials in New York State entered the house, not entirely sure whether that meant forcibly
with
or
otherwise. With Peanut's safety in mind.
Yeah, captured Peanut, and then because Peanut pretty reasonably had its morning disturbed, so he bit one of the animal control officials, at which point he had signed his own death warrant and was suitably euthanized. So but now I have this story becoming going viral in the US.
My understanding, though, was that Peanut's fate was sealed at the point of their entry, and the bite was
incidental.
Was incidental, okay, to his ultimate. Now, all of this Valerie ignores Fred.
Yeah, poor Fred. Now, Fred was Peanut's best friend. And he was a lovely little furry raccoon. Yep. And they lived very happily together along with the family cat. And they all slept together. Now, as Mark so rightly pointed out, this squirrel was an orphan. And his mom had been run over by a car. So these people ran out, rescued this poor little baby squirrel, bottle fed him and brought him to maturity. And he was a big part of their lives. So anyway, I think the neighbours complained or something. So in their wisdom, they sent in one of these combat teams to catch this very dangerous squirrel and the raccoon. And unfortunately, an officer got bitten. But
which again, I believe is incidental for both Fred and
allegedly.
Peanut. Indeed.
But on the off chance that the squirrel or the raccoon had rabies, they had to carry out a rabies test. But to get a rabies test done, you have to get at the brain. And that involves killing the animal first, because it's in the cerebellum where you find out about the rabies. I know a lot about this.
It's an unfortunate test to be told you need, isn't it, really?
It is, but yeah. They didn't tell us how the two animals were euthanized. And this is concerning me very much. Yeah. I mean, were they shot? Were they strangled?
Smothered.
Were they smothered? There's another suggestion,
John. I just struggle with the concept of waking up in the morning and thinking to myself, what am I going to do today? I'm going to complain about my neighbour's pet squirrel, you know?
Well, this is interesting because you would think, why are they talking about this? We're talking about this because it has become a political issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Elon Musk is now tweeting and joining a drumbeat of sort of right-wing conspiracy theorists who are saying the Democrats will euthanize your squirrel, but they won't stop crime in the cities. I'm not making this up. This is a wet issue.
But whilst that sounds laughable in many ways, it does feed into the narrative that that Biden and the whole woke agenda, as it's called in the US, under the Democrats and ACO and all of these people, that you've got a whole lot of very left-leaning politicians and officials who are deciding what it is that you, a free American citizen, can do with your life. So in a way, it's a very simple example, but it is actually quite clarifying for people who think that they are being told what to do and how to live their lives, and they don't want to be told that.
If you live in New York State, and if you are aware that it is illegal to have a wild squirrel and a wild raccoon in your house, maybe setting up an Instagram account and getting millions of followers to show people the presence of an illegal raccoon and an illegal squirrel is a bad idea.
But
one could disagree with the concept of it being wild.
Yes, and some people actually eat squirrels. Apparently, they are perfectly edible, Anton.
Yeah, they're tasty.
In fact, we had one person here earlier who was just telling us about this.
We also had Trump warning that immigrants were eating their cats, killing their cats, eating their cats. So maybe it's quite a thing in America.
Well, maybe the prompt is that taking this kind of light, whimsical story.
And it wasn't light and whimsical for Peanut.
Well, let me tell you.
No, my point is ultimately the fact that Peanut and Fred had access to euthanasia for us in a country where we can't even have a discussion about it, I think is an interesting provocation. And if the if Peanut and Fred's demise leads to there being a conversation in Ireland, which I'd definitely be part of.
But they didn't want to be euthanized.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
How do you know that? How do you know that?
I know.
How do you know that?
Every creature wants to live. So why would they require...
Oh my God, this has taken a very morbid
without
turn.
Without wanting it. I know, that's not good. They didn't really want it.
If you want to Google Peanut, there's pictures of him in a hat. He's very cute.
Or contribute and to his saddling. GoFundMe page.
How much is the GoFundMe up
to? It's
there?
Up to $36,000.
36 grand for a squirrel.
I don't know what they're going to do with
a mausoleum.
Maybe they'll
mausoleum.
Give it to one of the campaigns.
Squirrelism. I just wonder if I could dissociate myself from the last 3 minutes of radio, to be honest.
Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times, who will never come back. Valerie Cox, journalist and author. John Cunningham, relationship director with Morgan McKinney. Thank you very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.